come back with the great Stevie Ray Vaughan, who died on this day. Little Wing, that piece is called, died on this day in 1960 in a helicopter crash in Wisconsin. One of America's great bluesmen passed away on this day, and on this day in history, we remember Stevie Ray Vaughan and his music. We're now going to explore the questions of who is the Islamic State, but also why it seems to have so much weight with so many young Muslims in the Western world, especially in Europe and Australia and other places like that, and even in the United States to an extent as well. And we have a great panel with us here. Dr. Tabit Abdullah is with us, Associate Professor of Middle East History and Associate Dean for External Relations at York University in Toronto, specializes in medieval and early modern Iraq. His most recent books are Dictatorship, Imperialism, and Chaos, Iraq Since 1989, and A Short History of Iraq. Joyce Davis, author of Martyrs, Innocence, Vengeance, and Despair in the Middle East, Between Jihad and Salam, Profiles of Islam, and President of the World Affairs Council of Harrisburg. And Dr. Syed Farid Alatas, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at the National University of Singapore and one of the world's leading scholars in the Islamic world. Thank you all three for joining us. This is really, I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
The number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to me here at talk@steinershow.org, log on to our Facebook pages, tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. This is, you know, since this began, and we can talk a bit about, and I want to talk a bit about, especially with Tabit, about the Islamic State and what it means for people living in Syria and Iraq and how to address that. But let me begin where we said we were going to start, which is all the reports that there could be thousands of young Muslims from across Europe especially, but maybe 100 or so from America, in fighting for Islamic State, and what's underlying that? Do we think what the driving, if not into the fight itself, emotionally supporting Islamic State? Let me start, if I could, with you, Dr. Alatas.
Well, you know, if we look at the experience that we had with Afghanistan. Some years ago, we found that from places like Indonesia and Malaysia, people went to Afghanistan to fight alongside the Taliban, you know, against the invading Americans and, you know, other forces for a variety of reasons. So in many cases, they bought into the Taliban ideology, but there were so many other cases you know, in which people were out of jobs, they felt disenfranchised in their own country, in Indonesia, for example. Many of them were mercenaries, and this was an opportunity for them to get out of that and to earn some money. For some people, it was, as I said, they bought into the Taliban ideology. They were fighting the West. They were fighting the, you know, the great Satan. So I think we find the same thing happening in Iraq and Syria right now. If there are some parallels between European or Western Muslims in the West supporting the Islamic State and those in Southeast Asia who are supporting the Islamic State, I think we find a variety of reasons for which people are willing to go to Syria and Iraq, fight alongside these militants and kill other Muslims, Shiites, Christians, and Yazidis, and so on. So I think it's a combination of buying into the Salafi ideology, as well as mercenaries going to fight for other reasons, including maybe trying to get out of a bad situation in their own country, trying to get out of unemployment and stuff like that.
And Joyce Davis, one of the things that I see from the European press, and I've been really fascinated to watch these debates going on in England, there's this huge debate happening on the radicalization of Muslim youth in Europe. And you see this debate, these fault lines where you have Tariq Ramadan is a professor of Islamic studies, talking about that Muslims throughout Europe and in England and Britain have not been acknowledged as citizens of Europe, despite the interaction between Muslims and Christians from Turkey, Bosnia, Spain, and more than that. And others coming in saying, because Muslims separate themselves and are associated with terrorism, you can really see in this debate taking place among European scholars on this issue where this divide might live and why this might be happening.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think I've looked at this issue now for the past decade or more as a reporter and as a scholar, you know, working on my books. And there clearly is a problem with extremism, Islamic extremism in Europe, far more, I think, than in the United States. Now, there are some reasons for that. The nature of the immigrants to Europe, Muslim immigrants and those to the U.S., are distinctly different. Some of the studies have shown clearly that they're more educated and have more means when they come to the United States, and there's more of an opportunity for them to assimilate, this being a nation of immigrants. So this anger, this pent-up anger that's there at the living conditions, at the isolation from society, and at their strong connections to the countries that they've left and the issues that they've left, all of this feeds into. And of course, you know, if you have people who are disenfranchised, who are angry, who are still connected to the issues in their old time, you have a perfect storm brewing.
And one of the things that I've noticed, Talbot, about between the polling and taking place in Europe that says like as high as 16% of people in France support the Islamic State and large numbers of young people in like 28%, you see the exact opposite of numbers coming up in Gaza, where people are saying by 85% they can't stand the Islamic State and they're not the same as Hamas and we don't support it. Maybe the Western experience has something to do with fueling this. I mean, what are your thoughts on this, Talbot?
Well, I think it goes really beyond Islam and Muslims and the alienation, the legitimate debate about alienation of Muslim immigrants in Europe. There is something that goes beyond all of this, and one can get a sense of it by looking back into history. I mean, certain events capture the imagination of disillusioned elements that feel that they are oppressed and alienated and so forth, and become sort of an internationalist rallying cry. I think though it's very risky to compare a vile phenomena like the Islamic State with something, you know, far more noble, like, for example, the Spanish, you know, Republic before World War II. But there is some element there where an event that is seen as some sort of a cause that is a rallying cry against oppression captures the imagination all over the world. And in fact, this goes back all the way to the medieval periods, where certain events attract elements that feel oppressed and alienated. It's a very sad statement that the age we live in, essentially a neo-fascist movement, acts as this kind of a magnet for individuals with very legitimate concerns about oppression and alienation. I think it's part of the loss that progressives feel in terms of really presenting an alternative to fascism, an alternative to oppressive systems.
Well, picking up on the point that Talbot just made, Syed, this is, I think, it could be an interesting place to kind of talk about this. I mean, there's a juxtaposition, it seems to me, from the colonial era, the post-World War I era of the West dominating the Arab world and much of the Muslim world, but the Arab world in particular. This is the anniversary today of the installation of King Faisal by the British in 1921 in Iraq. And that and the kind of the secular nationalist Islamic resistance to colonialism, the support of America for these dictators, the destruction of, as Talbot was saying, kind of the more open-minded secular left and liberal groups inside of the Islamic world, and they have, and people like the IS kind of filling that void. I mean, is that a piece of this? Isn't that a large piece of this?
Well, you know, there are Muslims with different orientations, all of whom, you know, believe, have similar grievances, you know, against colonialism, against neocolonialism, against U.S. interference in internal affairs, and so on and so forth. That's not the problem. The problem is the particular orientation of this group, of the Islamic State. I mean, let me just explain that. You find that the media, I think practically all over the world, is referring to the Islamic State as consisting of Sunni militants. Now, this is in itself a problem because they are, for the most part, not Sunni militants. But by calling them Sunni militants, the impression is given that this is a war between Sunnis and Shiites, as well as non-Muslims such as Christians and Yazidis and so on. The fact of the matter is, not only has the IS been killing Sunnis, but they have their roots in the Salafi movement. They are a breakaway from Al-Qaeda. They are very virulently anti-Sunni Islam. Abu Musab Zarqawi, the founder of ISIS, has been known to have said that Sufis are the enemies of Islam alongside Shiites and non-Muslims and so on. So I think the problem is not about the grievances. I think even terrorist organizations have got legitimate grievances when they talk about not being in control, that Muslims are not in control of their own destiny. There is unfairness in U.S. foreign policy. It's tends towards Israeli interests and so on and so forth. In this way, they share grievances with peace-loving Muslims. But the problem is the orientation, how they want to go about the solution, their attitude towards non-Muslims, their intolerance towards other Muslims, you know, the whole takfiri ideology, the ideology of pronouncing excommunication on other Muslims. This, I think, are some of the worrying things about the Islamic State and the fact that they've been actually able to capture territory, unlike Al Qaeda, and are gaining adherence around the world is very worrying because what we are seeing really is a split in the Muslim world and the potential, you know, for there to be higher intensity of Sunni-Shiite conflict. And I think the media doesn't do justice to all of this by referring to them as Sunni militants.
So let's come back and bring what Syed was saying, Joyce, and over to Tabit. I mean, and please just jump in as freely as you want. Please join us here at 410-319-8888 and write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. But now we are in this position where they're saying purportedly that thousands of Western European young Muslims, maybe hundreds of British young Muslims and maybe 100 or so American young Muslims have joined IS. And as Tabit alluded to earlier, you know, the passion of things like the Spanish Civil War was one of those times that drew thousands of people to fight for a cause against the fascists in Spain. But this is a very different kind of cause. So I think the West needs to really wrestle with why this is happening, why so many why this has kind of captured the hearts and minds of so many young people in the Islamic communities throughout the West.
Yeah, I mean, I think you raise a good point. The West needs to grapple with it and to see how it can help Muslims in their societies become more integrated. But I think this is a bigger problem for Islam. I mean, we do have the issue that this is a group that is being associated with Islam, that is defaming the religion, and that is pulling away young people. I mean, that is, bringing them into militancy. I actually thought that we would see a diminishing of Islamic militancy after the atrocities of Al-Qaeda in Iraq when they were beheading fellow Muslims. Now we see this happening again. is there enough education happening in Islam and in Muslim homes about what Islam really teaches? What ISIS is doing, what IS is doing, is far from what Islamic precepts call for.
Tabit?
If I could just maybe turn this in a slightly different direction.
Please do. Go ahead. What are you thinking? Yeah,
I think it's very important to underline a couple of facts about ISIS. First of all, the most important reason for the emergence of this movement is the destruction of the Iraqi state. This is something extremely, that somehow is being forgotten in all of this. It's not just about, you know, Islam and the extremist tendencies within Islam. That exists everywhere. I mean, anybody that listens to John Hagee would tremble in his about extremism in Christianity, and of course it exists in all other religions. It's not just about education in the Islamic world, though I think that is an important issue and that Muslims definitely must pay attention to this. But the simple fact here is you had a state which was a dictatorship, of course, and I, for one, you know, am a victim of it. But the destruction of the state itself, not just the removal of the regime, but of the state itself, the destruction of its institutions, the destruction of its infrastructure, the refusal of the United States to invest what was necessary in terms of peacekeeping forces after the occupation, the active participation of the United States in actually undermining some self-governing initiatives that emerged after 2003. All of this is the ISIS is a direct result of this. Secondly, ISIS is primarily an Iraqi phenomenon, though of course it controls half of its control is in Syria. Almost all of its commanders are Iraqis, with a few coming in from abroad, you know, from the Chechens and so forth. It's a primarily Iraqi phenomena. It primarily recruits from depends on popular support from a region north of Baghdad up to Mosul, which has historically had a very strong sense of social solidarity, very different from the other parts of Iraq in that it did not have an intense form of class divisions and feudalism, and therefore the population there tended to be more interested in universalist kind of ideologies like pan-Arabism or now pan-Islamism, rather than, you know, ideas of democracy or socialism or ideas that talk about class struggle and so forth, which were more popular among the Kurds and the South. The last thing I want to say about this is that the sense of despair, the sense of continuous humiliation and despair that the region feels also continuously fuels this unbelievable sense of violence. I don't think that, you know, the destruction of Al-Qaeda or even the destruction, say, of ISIS, which is bound to happen actually at some point, I think this is a dead-end movement, but the price will be very high. This does not guarantee that this won't happen again. What the underlying issues are the destruction of the state institutions and the sense of humiliation and despair which continues in the region.
If I just, at the risk of being provocative, I do hear what you're saying, but I would simply say that I don't think you can simply brush this off as the United States' fault. And the fact is that there are serious problems within this part of the world that they should have been able to take care of. They should have been able to get rid of Saddam Hussein until all of this became a threat to the rest of the world and to Americans. So I hear what you're saying, but this blaming the United States for all of the problems going on in the Muslim world right now is also a very dead end. Somehow, and what I think Obama is calling for, is that the Iraqis have to stand up, shake off all of this extremism, and get their house in order. This is something the Muslim people have to do for themselves. And there is chaos within Islam right now. And I think that to deny that is to really avoid the real solution to the problem the whole world is facing.
Tabit, let me let you respond before we go back to Syed.
Well, no, I don't disagree with this at all. I've spent most of my academic life emphasizing that the main cause for instability in Iraq, at least, but I would say, you know, in most of the Middle East, you know, I haven't really studied Afghanistan or Pakistan, so I don't know about the Muslim world in general. But the heart of the Middle East, say from Egypt to Iraq, perhaps with the exception of the Palestinian issue, primarily the problems there are internal. But the role of the United States in the destruction of the state of Iraq cannot be whitewashed. You know, and it is also gigantic in terms of its influence. So that, you know, it's so easy, of course, to point a finger and say, well, you should have gotten rid of the dictator. There are so many dictators around the world, so many, you know, incredibly oppressive states. The fact is that many of these states actually have incredible ability at longevity and ability to retain power. I agree that the people in the region should look at themselves very clearly and, you know, in a very honest way, but the manner in which the United States destroyed the infrastructure in Iraq, this was not something that is internal. The aerial bombardment is something that is actually external, and then the invasion and occupation and the role that the United States played in the setting up of or the lack of institutions that emerged is a very, very large one, without denying the fact that Iraqis bear a huge share of the blame in not being able to rise to the occasion of the opportunity that the American invasion actually presented them.
Syed, let me let you take us to break here with a thought from what you heard from both of our other guests.
Yes, I mean, I think the political economic context is very important, notwithstanding the fact that Muslims within Iraq as well as the region have some responsibility for, you know, the development of extremist ideologies amongst them. But the U.S. has to take the blame also for the reasons that were just stated just now. So does Saudi Arabia, so does Qatar, so does Turkey, to the extent that they have been players in ensuring the conflict. And I think the U.S. probably hasn't done enough to rein certainly the Saudis in for whatever support they've been lending to ISIS. Perhaps not official Saudi support, but private Saudi businessmen who have been contributing to ISIS. The fact that there was the invasion of Iraq and the fall of Saddam, which led to a Shiite government, a Shiite government that was in its own way extremist under Nouri al-Maliki, which functioned to alienate the Sunnis and left the gap for ISIS to fill. So there are various external as well as internal causes. I don't think anyone is putting all the blame on the United States, but they have an important role to play, and I think it's not been very constructive. Having said that, there's no running away from the fact that Muslims are responsible for the development of extremism in their own midst. One cannot run away from the fact that the Saudis have been instrumental in the spread of Salafism throughout the Muslim world. Since the 1970s, in the 1980s, particularly after the Iranian Revolution, there has been this rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran for supremacy, and the Saudis have been supporting sectarianism, and they have been successful to the extent that now Salafized Sunnis, if I may use that term, have been going to Syria and to Iraq from all over the Muslim world in order to kill Shiites. So there is great responsibility that the Muslims have for this.
So we're going to take a very brief break. And when we come back, we're going to be rejoined by our three guests here. And I want to tackle with what I think we've opened up here is the complexity of what not just the Islamic world is facing and the Arab world is facing, but the world is facing with the Islamic State. And we've touched on this deep complexity. And so what is a response? both in terms of what's happening inside the Arab and Muslim world, but also what's happening in the West, and where we might go from here over the next decade. So we'll be right back with Dr. Saeed Farid Alatas, Joyce Davis, and Dr. Tabat Abdullah to wrestle with IS, the West, and where we go. Stay with us. We're going to go out with Cesaria Vora, the great Cesaria Vora. And Soda, today is her birthday, 1941, she was born. Coming back with Pride and Joy. The great Stevie Ray Vaughan died in a helicopter crash on this day in 1990. And we continue our discussion of the Islamic State here with our guest, Dr. Tabat Abdullah, Associate Professor of Middle East History and Associate Dean for External Relations at York University in Toronto, and the author of Dictatorship, Imperialism, and Chaos, Iraq since 1989. Joyce Davis, author of Martyrs, Innocence, Vengeance, and Despair in the Middle East, Dr. Saeed Farid Alatas, Assistant Professor, Associate Professor of Sociology at the National Institute of Singapore. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. I mean, talk@steinershow.org. You know, and we see the news this morning where a young American man, Douglas MacArthur McCain, who was originally from Chicago, I believe, or Minneapolis, was killed while fighting for the Islamic State. And one of thousands of young Westerners. And I dare say that maybe what's fueling this from different ends, both in terms of its limited but powerful support in inside the Islamic world, being fueled in some ways by the Qataris and by the Saudis, as Saeed was saying, and fueled in some ways by what Tabat was saying in terms of what the U.S. Destroying the entire infrastructure of Iraq and other infrastructure of Syria being destroyed has led to this. But I think in some ways the support is very different, and why it's coming from young Westerners and why it's coming from inside the Middle East itself, Joyce Davis.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think part of the, we've gotten to it that Americans frequently do not understand the dynamics in this region because they don't pay much attention to it. Our media is not really doing a good job of educating and informing. Most of the media people have cut back, and it's dangerous. As we see now with the beheading of a journalist, it's dangerous for reporters to be there. But these young people who are connected to the region, I think most of them would have some connection through family otherwise to the region, do get the information. They do seek out the sources, and they generally are able to read information in the languages that they are being written. So, you know, they have information. They know what's going on, and many of them are angry. But I don't think we should overemphasize it. Of course, a few angry people can do a lot of harm, but it should not really, you know, mislead us into thinking that the vast majority of Muslims in the West are militant. That would be the wrong message to take out of this.
I agree with that, though I do know from Tabat, from a number of families and friends that we have and mutually in common, Tabat, their families have been approached by al-Qaeda groups and groups like IS to join them. I mean, this is happening because people are disaffected, feel the discrimination, feel separated from society in the West, and I think that in part is fueling what's going on, at least from the Western participants.
I agree with Professor Davis that one shouldn't, you know, over-exaggerate this, and it can easily spin out of control into thinking that, you know, every Muslim is a suspect and so forth. This is, of course, ridiculous. In fact, you know, as Professor Attas mentioned, that the number one victims of ISIS have actually not just been Muslims, but have been Sunni Muslims. And one of my biggest fears in the fallout of all of this will be a backlash against Sunni Muslims in general, especially in Iraq. I think that community is the one that is mostly endangered by the rise of this fanatical group. But in terms of support in the West, you know, I can tell you as a professor and as one, you know, an Arab and very much in touch with the community here, you can be baffled, you can be astounded by how prevalent the activities of some of these extremist groups not all of them, of course, calling for violence, but very much their ideology is the first step toward going in that direction. You know, this Wahhabism, this notion that the literal meaning of the Quran stands above all else, and that the jihad is one of the most important precepts of the religion, is in fact quite widespread. Even you know, among my students, I've had students of mine come and tell me that they've been approached, and there is this phenomena. It's not the one that will decide whether this extremist tendency that is now engulfing the Middle East is going to continue or not. But for Western countries, say for the United States or for Canada, you know, where I live, or especially in Europe, I think people should take this very seriously in terms of efforts at assimilating immigrant communities, but also not just immigrant communities, as we saw now with this young man, McCain. You know, it's all disaffected, all people who feel lost and are sort of wanderers looking for some kind of a new break, a new start. This is an opportunity, and there are sharks out there willing to feast on them.
That's a very powerful point you've made, and we have to conclude the discussion. I just really, I hope people can listen to this and reflect on what we've been talking about today. And Syed, let me just ask you this one final thought. I mean, you know, I was also thinking about what you said a moment ago, Tabit, and we little covered in the American press, at least by not the popular press, but like you look at the Shuatite, if I said it right, Tat tribe, Sunnis in Syria, hundreds were slaughtered by IS when they tried to resist them taking over their lands. Right. So it's not just – so what is, from your perspective, a response from the Islamic world, if there can be one?
Well, I think, of course, cleaning up their own house, you know, better governance to prevent this, you know, large-scale disaffection and disenfranchisement of Muslims, that's obvious. But apart from that, I think the Muslim world now more than ever has to take more seriously this whole idea of intra-Muslim dialogue, you know, Sunni-Shiite dialogue. Put the Aman message into practice. You know, some 10 years ago, Muslim religious scholars and political leaders from around the world got together to affirm the unity of Islam and declared it wrongful for Sunnis to declare Shiites as
if I might just add, I think that's a great idea. Someone,
Joyce, let me just say it finish.
Recently suggested there should be some sort of international conference on Islam for the 21st century that would really bring together true scholars and people that can define the religion and distance it from extremism. Boy, wouldn't that be wonderful for the world.
And say, let me let you finish your thought before we have to take a break.
Sorry, can I say something? Hello.
My last point is this. I agree with what has been said about, you know, people being disenfranchised and wanting to start over and being attracted to the so-called, you know, IS cause. But I also want to add that the Muslims anywhere, and I think this is also true of Europe and the United States, Muslims who are uprooted from their community are more likely to join groups like Al-Qaeda and IS. You know, a Muslim in London or Birmingham or New York who attends a mosque which is more of a, you know, has a more of a Sufi orientation, is rooted in, you know, Islamic spirituality, and comes from a family which is rooted in some age-old tradition, is much less likely to join a Salafi group. So there is also this issue of being uprooted from Islamic tradition.
I do want to thank the three of you. We had to take a break here, but this has been a fascinating discussion. I really appreciate the time that all of you have taken. Dr. Syed Farah Alatas joining us from Singapore. Thank you so much for being part of this program. And Joyce Davis joining us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Thank you so much, Dr. Tabit Abdallah, now in Toronto. Good to have three of you with us. And I want to thank our colleague and friend, Suni Khalid, for helping us organize and talk about what guests should be on today's program. Thank you three so much for this erudite conversation. I deeply appreciate it.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you. My pleasure to be on the show. Goodbye.
All right. So we're going to take a brief break and come right back with our next segment, which will be looking at Lyme disease in our world and why it's so, why it is so prevalent and what the dangers are, because it can hit any of us. So don't go away. We will be right back.